Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to the midweek version of Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for people who play with needles, love people who play with needles, and love people who love people who play with needles.
Something like that.
Yes, all of that. So, okay. And I've also caught myself saying so a lot, so I'm going to be working on that.
I'm sure we both have our verbal tics readers will be, or readers, listeners will be happy to point out for us.
This one has been cropping up for me. I was listening. We were editing Mary Corbett Sunday, and I was editing that and cleaning it up a little bit. And boy, I say so a lot. So that's going to have to stop. Yep. I'll be
just
working.
Spell it S-E-W, and then it's fine.
Yeah, I'll go that route, sure. I'll go there. So, yes, we do want to, Mary Corbett Sunday. Oh, man, we had such a great chat with her.
We so did. That was great.
Yeah, I had to cut it off. That was one where, I hate cutting any of them off, but we could have gone another full hour with her.
And it's funny because some of them, you sit and you've done an hour, and then other ones you look at your watch and you say, how did that happen?
Right. Exactly.
Where did that time go?
And that's what happened this time. Yeah. It flew by. And we'll talk at length about linen and the linen that Mary buys. And it's Alba Maxima linen from Legacy Linen. It's Alba Maxima 40 count white is what she buys just as her standard linen. And I had already ordered a week or so ago from Needle in a Haystack, ordered a half yard it was, of this linen, because I knew that's what she had, a standard that she liked, and you know darn well that she's just as picky as can be about that ground
cloth. Absolutely.
And holy smokes, no wonder she buys it. Oh, is it beautiful? Came today. Is it beautiful or what? It's just...
So, okay, what makes it best?
The quality, you can tell the quality, the body of the cloth, the weave, and we talk about whether there's fat and thin threads, webs and warps or whatever that is. No, it's all even, very few slubs, and they aren't even that big a deal. It's just a beautiful piece of cloth. I can see, and we talk about how it takes such a beating when she's stitching and tearing out, and you can see, I mean, it's just clear. It's just really beautiful linen, and
it's gonna hold up.
Yep, it is. And what I bought, a quarter yard, I guess, quarter or half yard, a 40 count, and it was $16. So it cost me $20 with shipping. And
well,
I tell
that's
you,
not bad at all.
No, and I wish I'd have bought a yard. I just should have bought a yard. But what a beautiful piece of cloth. Yep.
So. Well, and things like that, you know, it's a kind of thing that's a good stock up item, you know, because you know you're going to use it for something. That's not like, buying a particular thing. It's a base material that you would use.
Right. No, that's why I wish I'd bought a yard, because exactly that. It's never going to wear out. You just put it away somewhere where it's protected. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
That's like I have 18 count and Congress cloth needlepoint canvas. I just went and bought some.
It's just good to have.
Because, you know, doodle cloth, or if I just want to try something, I'll just pull that roll out, cut off a piece, and have at it. I keep it all wrapped up so it doesn't get dirty, and I keep it rolled so it doesn't get creased. But this Alba Maxima linen, and Mary talks about why she likes it and why it's so good. And yeah, I can tell. I don't need to even stitch one thing on it yet. And I can tell this stuff is spot on. It's beautiful.
And anything that's going to make the experience more enjoyable and less frustrating, and perhaps that's the thing is, you know, when you have materials that are not exactly what you need, it just gets frustrating because you know what you want to do and you can't because of the limitations of the materials. So those are good hints to have, because otherwise, you know, this is where you can really lean on someone else's experience that has stitched on so many different brands of linen or Congress cloth or whatever it is, silks, anything. And they say, this is the one that I use because, and you can, you know, skip a whole many years of trying out lots of things that are, you know, subpar. And it doesn't sound like that's one of the ones where it's, you know, it's good because it's expensive either.
No, I didn't. I mean, $20 for what I got. I mean, I have a lot of cloth for $20. I mean, that's, Needle in the Haystack, they were great. They are.
I've ordered from them before too, and I've always had a great experience.
Yep. And the other thing is when I took the thing out of the envelope and unfolded it, of course it's creased and has some wrinkles in it. And now after what I've been through with the other pieces of linen, I don't have that fear, because before that would have freaked me out. Like, oh no, how am I going to get this smooth? But nope, I know how to do that now. And
yeah.
Yep. Oh, this is going to be fun. Because this is my take a piece and a hoop on the road and stitch some Mary Corbett monogram letters and those kinds of things.
Just practice stuff. Yep. Right. So right now mine is, and I have to actually get it hooped up, is and I bought some wire and now I can't find it, which is a problem. but for the stump work piece that I'm working on, the wire slips are all done in a 4-inch hoop, so that's, you know, really portable, so I can just, you know, stuff that in a little Ziploc bag and I'll be able to take that anywhere. So that's going to be my piece that comes to work with me, I think.
Yes. Yeah, because we know you have to have something at work so you can scare the people.
I do, so that I don't. Yeah, it's either something's bad's going to happen. But it's those slips are, especially the ones I'm going to be working on are just all filled in long and short stitch. So it's just, you know, I don't need any guidance. I'm basically shading three colors and needle painting, and it's just long and short stitch. So there's nothing to bring as far as like charts or any of those things. So it's a great portable piece, because all I need is the hoop, the needle, the thread, and a pair of scissors, and I'm done.
Yep. So there you have it. Nope, I just said so again. All right, I'm going to start counting them. Got to stop it. And then Trish Burr, and I'm scrambling here to find it. Trish Burr made available her her white work with color, made available free. I'm not finding it. Oh, here it is. Yes, she did it. Bear with me. Yes, through Inspirations. Inspirations issue 96. If you are a person who gets Inspirations magazine, you'll be able to find it quickly. And if you're not, you need to get Inspirations magazine. But issue 96, which just came out, Trish Burr has in there her color white work with color Partridge in a Pear Tree, and you can download it for free, and through, if you're an Inspirations person, and then all of the threads and stuff are just common threads, nothing fancy, but it's a beautiful piece that she did, and I think that's going to get put on this Alba Maxima linen, is to do that one. But free. It's through Inspirations. You have to get it. I don't think I can just send it to anyone. But she's made it available because it's a project that's in that magazine. And of course, you can buy the kit, but it's mostly DMC floss and a couple others. It's not anything unusual. So to have the pattern and then just go at it. But I love her white work with color work. It's beautiful. And this is just a little thing. I mean, I don't even think it's maybe 4x5x7, something like that. Just a little thing that, I'm going to have fun stitching that. But, yeah, she gives all the download, gives all the instructions and what to do and so on and so forth. But, So there you have it. The instructions are in the Inspirations magazine. You just got to get that Inspirations magazine. I love when that new issue comes, because it's just so beautiful. And I get the digital version. I don't get the paper version.
Mm-hmm.
So I just get it, and then I have it on my iPad. And so I have all of them. Or not all of them. I don't have all 96 of them, but I keep them all on there. You know, I wish I had all 96.
It's nice to browse.
Oh, yeah, it is. And just the work is just... And then I get the weekly newsletter.
Yes.
Yes.
So I was just going to say... because it sort of brought to mind, there's a lot of shops that have really good weekly newsletters or every once in a while newsletters. The Attic is one. Nordic Needle is another. So if you haven't signed up for those newsletters, you're really missing out, because it's not just a here's what's on sale kind of, you know, there's information, there's interviews with people, you know, tons and tons of really good content in there that pops into your email. So definitely worth taking a look at those.
Yep. The Inspirations and the Attic are the two for me. Mm-hmm. And every Friday I look forward to the Inspirations newsletter, because they just always have beautiful photography, but also they get submissions from people who just do amazing work. So it's really, it's fun to look at. And I really enjoy that newsletter every Friday morning. That's a good one. Yep. So, there's another one. Birthday gift. You got a birthday gift. I want to hear about your birthday gift.
Out on Instagram, didn't you?
I did. Talk to me.
It was a surprise to me, too. So, you all were teasing me about Fiber Talk, the podcast for people who play with needles and the people who love people who play with needles. But clearly,
that's not going to stop.
I know. Well, and here's why. Because clearly somebody was listening, because somebody who loves someone who plays with needles bought me an antique sampler for my birthday.
Oh, man.
And so now this is not a hands across the sea gigantic sampler that's ultimately detailed or any of those things. How big is it? It's probably 18 inches by 20 inches or so, I would
say. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
But it is, pending authentication of all of those things, I should say ahead of time. But I've so far been trying to trace back into the sampler, and everything so far is pretty legit. So the sampler is, I think, was probably done by a very young girl. Her name was Jessie Cameron, and it just says the only identifying things on it are her name, school poetry, which is in Skye, Scotland, and 1857. So I don't have her age, so I don't know what year she was born, but just based on the stitching, I think it's likely that she was very young. And the fabric itself is pretty rough, like it's a very wide weave, almost burlappy kind of fabric. Mm-hmm. And so I know nothing about real antique samplers, and I've seen probably none and only seen reproductions and things. So I really have nothing to go on, you know, to judge it by, as far as, you know, to be able to say, oh, well, because of this cloth, it was probably this or that, or, but it's lots of colors, and it's definitely aged and could use a good cleaning. But it's really, really interesting, because it's mostly a lot of alphabets, and I'll put more pictures of it on Instagram and Facebook. But what I found most interesting, and again, because I know nothing, this may be something that's very common, there was an entire alphabet done in what looks like an eyelet stitch. And I don't know if it's called an eyelet stitch. That's another thing I've been trying to dig into in the 5 minutes since I received it. It is a stitch where the girl who stitched it basically is stitching circles almost outward. And at first it almost looked like pulled thread, where you would, you know, or like cut work. But it isn't, because the fabric is so almost burlappy, and the fibers, like you were talking about this linen, how dense it is and everything. This is the opposite of that. So what she was able to do is basically just move the threads away and then sew outward, sort of like in a wheel, to make an eyelet. So there's an entire alphabet of letters formed of these outlets, one after another, after another. So, and I've never seen that in a sampler before. Again, like I said, that doesn't mean anything. It could be a very common thing.
It's, I think it's fairly common.
So
I think it is. So
it's lots and lots and lots of stitches. And so the lovely person who gave it to me also has listened enough to say, I was going to frame this for you, but I knew you would want to look at the back. So it's not framed yet. So I have it just raw. Because that's, of course, immediately what I wanted to do was to look at the back and see, you know, what the work looked like from there. And, you know, that also gives you a little indication of the skill of the stitcher and maybe give you an idea of age and things like that. So, yeah, so I've been just having a ball, you know, taking pictures of it and then digging through Ancestry and trying to find, you know, a little bit about, you know, if this is, you know, where this came from. And just the same way as anybody would do, I guess, with an antique sampler. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful in its simplicity and in how a primitive isn't the word that I'm looking for. Innocent. That's about the best word I can use to describe it. It's not a sophisticated sampler at all. So there's not a lot of, you know, there's not a border. There's not a lot of elements that were planned out. You can tell that this was truly a sampler made for the purpose of stitching. And it was done at school because it's got the school name on it. So I really think this was a learning piece. You know, mm-hmm. That's kind of the way it strikes me.
Yeah.
So pretty much the exact opposite of the Uffendel samplers from Hands Across the Sea that we've been talking about, which are pretty elaborate, and I think a little bit more advanced in the stitching because it's, you know, over two, but then there's some stitches that are over one, and this is all the opposite of that, which kind of makes it very charming to me.
Okay, I'm dying to know. Tell me about the color difference front to back. Are the colors on the back infinitely more vivid? What's that like?
You know what? A little bit, but I'll do the same thing. I'll take a couple of pictures and post them side by side so that you can see.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, is there a noticeable difference?
There's a little, yeah, there is. And to be honest, I'll be quite frank. So again, I haven't had it long, so I haven't really had time to study it. but I was more focused on the content of it. And less about, you know, taking it apart visually and really examining every bit of it. But now that you mention it, I will make a note, a point of looking at that in particular, and I'll take a couple of pictures and post them together so that you can see exactly, you know, what one small area looks like on the front and the corresponding area on the back.
Yeah, because see, my curiosity is just how vivid and saturated the colors were in their threads. It's just a curiosity thing for me. Were they akin to what we have today? Were the colors
surprisingly
not as
rich? Yes.
Oh, were they were? Okay.
No. Yeah. They were. I think, you know, there's less again less sophistication with the tone of the color. So now we sort of work with colors that are very finely tuned. So it'll be green, but it's got a hint of gray in it, or it's red, but it's toned with yellow. Mm-hmm. And you know that, I mean, that's how you build a color that's interesting to look at, you know, from makeup. So this is my experience with color is mostly with learning how to make makeup, right? So it's very easy to make a blue eyeshadow. But to make a beautiful blue eyeshadow, you take pure blues and then you mute them, you add black and you add white, and it mutes everything down and just creates a little bit more of sophistication to the color. Mm-hmm. When you start doing that. And then by adding undertones of maybe brown or undertones sometimes of yellow or other things, that's where you create a color that's visually interesting as opposed to looking like something that came out of preschool.
Right. Yeah.
If that makes sense. So it's it's deviating from the primary color, not so much even on the color wheel going from, say, red to orange. But, you know, by adding those other colors in, you create a more sophisticated color to your eye. This is like that. The colors are vivid, but there's not a lot of these muted tones. So there was another sampler we had been talking about that had very nice, like soft pinks, like rose colored pinks and those sorts of things. This is kind of the opposite of that. This is more in line with what you would expect a child to stitch with. You know, if you gave a child, you know, a bunch of colors, you know, the adult would pick the things that were perhaps more subtle, and a child would pick the things that were more vibrant and clear. And there's a reason mm-hmm. why preschools are the colors that they are.
Like jumbo 8 crayons.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it is kind of like that. So, but they're clear. They're not faded. I think the fabric itself has probably been affected more, but I honestly don't know what the fabric looked like when it was stitched. So I can't say how much of it is just age and how much is, because it could be that this literally is kind of burlappy fabric. That's just scrap fabric that the school was able to get.
Yeah.
You know, this was not a piece that looks like it was stitched for hanging in a house to attract a husband. This was, here, you're going to learn your alphabet. Here's a piece of scrap paper, you know, go to it.
Yeah.
That's kind of what this reminds me of. And it's charming. It's absolutely charming.
Sure, sure. No, I think I was excited when I saw it. So yeah. I saw that in the little bit that you showed that the thread is gone from some of the letters. Is
little
that just
bit.
Just a few of them?
Yes. Yes. Okay. It's not too terrible.
Yeah.
It's not in tremendously great shape.
I think it's fun. I don't care what shape it's in. I think it's,
you know,
fun.
160 yeah. years old. So it's in about the shape you would expect a 160-year-old piece of fabric to be. But yeah, it's kind of cool because then you think about what was going. That's pre-Civil War in the U.S. This was in Scotland. So you know, then you get into who was the monarch at the time, and you know. You can get into all of those things. So I've been doing a little bit of research here and there as I've had time, but like I said, I've only had it for a few days. So I don't know very much about it, but what a surprise, what an utter and complete surprise, because it was totally unexpected.
Yeah. Oh, it's very cool. It's very cool.
For someone to actually go out and who has no needlework experience at all and find out where to find such things. And then to choose one was really, really pretty special. So
that's neat. That's neat.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it'll be fun to hang it next to something that's a completely different kind of sampler too. So,
right. Well, the fun of trying to discover as much history about it as possible is, to me, you can look at it and then start to piece together. I mean, well, like Nicholas talked about a million times, you start to piece together, you know, like you said, who the monarch was, what life was like, and pull all that together. And then that just takes on more meaning with each discovery. You know,
it's fantastic. It does. Yeah. When you know what happened with the girl who stitched it, you know, was she married? Did she have a family? Was, you know, where did she come from? Like So, yeah, so that's a whole, side hobby, because I need another hobby. is now, and I'm not one to I've never done that with my own family. My own family has basically no history due to, you know, just bad historians and records lost in wars and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So I've never done the whole trace your family back five generations sort of thing. And I really, quite frankly, haven't had the interest in it. But yet this little girl that I've never met, now I want to meet her. Isn't that funny?
I think it's fantastic. So, I really do. It's just tremendous.
So that was kind of a great surprise.
That's a treat. That's a treat right there. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to have that happen on your 21st birthday too, you know, that's special in its own. Its own right. So yay for
Stop
you.
It. So, okay. So yeah. So, all right. As long as you're making fun of how old I am, sir.
Oh, I can make fun because I got you by 20 plus years. So.
I know you don't. I know you do not. You think you do, but you do not.
Okay.
How could you not know this? How long have we known each other?
I never
A long
asked.
Time.
I never asked. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. So anyway, I had a, so I've been complaining about my vision for a while, haven't I?
Yes. Oh, yes, we have to hear about that, your vision.
Yeah,
yes.
so I've worn glasses for distance since I was a little girl. And then when I hit probably about 43, my near vision started going, as everyone's does. And of course, the first thing that I noticed, I could read perfectly fine, but when I was trying to stitch anything or knit, I couldn't see. And that was the key to, oh, yeah, you've got old eyeballs now. So I'd gotten progressive lenses a long time ago, and I've been working with those, and that's fine. But since I've been stitching, I've just been absolutely struggling to see. And I've tried magnification, I've tried lights, and what has ended up happening is I just take my glasses off because I can't, I literally can't make out things unless they're 2 inches from my face. So clearly this is a problem. And quite frankly, it was a little frightening because I'm thinking, you know, if this is really bad, like how, you know, I am older, but I am not elderly yet. So I think of my great grandmother crocheting, and she was nearly blind, but she was able to do it because crocheting is pretty big, right? Fine needlework is not that. So, so I finally went to the eye doctor, and lo and behold, my eyes have changed dramatically. So the reason I can't see is because my near vision has gotten significantly worse. So it's not just an anomaly. It's just, you're getting old, and that's what your eyeballs do. So, so what the doctor did, and I thought this was cool, and this is why I brought it up. We were talking about, you know, so what do you do for a living? What tasks do you do? What are your eyes required to do on a daily basis? And I said, well, you know, I do regular, you know, I work in a lab and a factory, and I do a lot of computer work. So I do that kind of thing. And I read a ton, but I do a lot of stitching. He said, interesting. And I said, I'm really, really struggling with my stitching because I just can't make out detail. Right. And, you know, I just went through the whole thing. And he said, okay, so this is what we're going to do. I'm writing you two prescriptions. One is going to be for regular eyeglasses that a normal person would wear. And then I'm going to write you a prescription for sewing glasses. And I said, okay, yes.
Okay.
So this is what he did. So the difference is that my regular glasses correct for distance visions, which I can't see anything beyond my own fingertips, clearly. And then my near vision is now progressively getting worse, and that's fine. So he corrected for that. But for my sewing glasses prescription, he actually added a higher degree of correction to it. So what that translates to would be almost like a magnification. So if I were to wear readers over my glasses, so what he did was he overcorrected for me.
Uh-huh.
And what it allows me to do is, and so we went through this whole thing of, you know, where do you hold your stitching? How far away from your face do you hold it? And so what he did was he corrected it so that my vision is perfect. My normal glasses perfect at the length that you would have a computer or a book or something like that. But my stitching glasses, he corrected so that my focal length and the place where the focus is perfect is exactly where I hold my stitching.
Excellent.
How cool is that?
You win.
So, yeah. So, you know, I get to spend lots and lots of money on eyeglasses, but it will mean that I can actually see.
Yes.
Which, how nice will that be?
Yeah. Yeah. The cost kind of goes away when you can actually see. Yes.
Yeah. And really, I mean, honestly, I was getting concerned because I'm thinking, you know, I have family history of cataracts and things like that. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what do I do if, you know, if I have some other vision problem that's more serious that could result in a loss of vision, you know, so great. I pick up this needlework and I'm really interested. And it's really got me excited. And then if I only have 4 or 5 years before I go blind because I have a retinal disease, like that's not good. So
right.
So no, I'm just old is really what it comes down to. So good for me.
Yep.
And so for people that are struggling, you know, the magnification, and again, I use a big ring light with a magnifier on it, which is tremendously helpful, but maybe this is an option for people if they do wear glasses, to have them overcorrect so that you can use them for stitching.
Yeah. Now, I'll be curious to see if you end up just putting your magnifier away because these work so well, or just what you're doing. Yeah.
It may be, because what I also have, so I've been using, I do a couple of things. I'll either use a magnifier that's on a stand, or I have a very sexy headlamp / magnifier.
Hey, I've seen those, and people swear by them. They look dorky, but people swear by them. They say they're great.
Yeah. The only thing I would do with mine, and mine was very inexpensive because I just wanted to see kind of what it was like. And it came, I got it on Amazon. It came with 5 different corrections of lens. So basically it's a lamp, and then you snap in what is essentially reading glasses. So it's a magnifier, but it does the same thing as readers would do for you. So what I can do is I can flip those down over my regular glasses to add additional correction,
mm-hmm.
or leave them off. But it's great. It is really great. And the only thing I would do is if I do buy another one, I would just buy one with a stronger lamp, because for me, I find having really bright light is helpful.
Yeah, that light. Well, it's so, you know, Mary and so many of, you know, how important that good light is. That
And my house does not have good light anywhere, yeah. So it all has to be artificial light.
Yeah. So now that when I got my magnifier with the LED ring light around it, holy smokes, that just changed the
world
game.
World of difference.
Yeah, and it was more the light than the magnifying.
Absolutely. And so that's the other thing, is that as you age, your eye takes in less light, which is why, you know, I walk into the room and I tell my son, put the light on, you're reading. And he says, I don't need a light. And then I realize that I hearken back to my parents and grandparents yelling at me for the same thing,
mm-hmm.
for not turning on lights in rooms when I was reading. And then I realized that it's because he has young eyeballs that actually take in a lot more light than ours do, because our lenses get cloudy.
Yep.
So
I don't need light, Mom. You're old. Leave me alone.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. He's slightly kinder than that sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, mostly it's just the eye roll of like, I'm fine, whatever.
The verbal cues are more powerful than any.
They are. So anyway. If you're having struggles, having good lighting and the ring light, what I like about it is that there's no shadows, right? Because you have light from lots of different sources.
Right.
If you're using a headlamp, it's a point source of light, and your hand can get in the way, and then you're shading your own light.
The ring light, because that's just when you're directional, then it seems like there's a shadow every time where you want to work,
mm-hmm.
and the ring light just eliminates that because there can't be. Yep.
Completely.
Yep. Well, that's pretty cool. I'd be interested to hear how those glasses work out. That's
I never thought of it, and this was just a really thorough doctor, and he's like, well, we'll create glasses that have different focal lengths, so because you read at a different distance than you would stitch, so. And then, you know, of course it became, well, I think the reason I'm stitching 2 inches from my face is because I can't see. And then he looked at me like, well, yeah, duh.
just remember to take those glasses off when you stand up, though.
right. So, yeah. So that's going to be good. So I'll be able to see and not struggle as much, and not be terrified of losing my sight.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that, especially if you have a history in your family, that – yeah, that leaps right to the forefront in terms of fears. Yeah, yeah. Do I get to do it earlier in life than anyone else? Oh,
right.
Boy. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And my family, my mother was legally blind, and my dad doesn't have great vision, and my eyeballs have always been, you know, weird since I was little. So, it is frightening. Like, I couldn't pick up a hobby that you don't have to see, you know. I have to get to the point where my vision starts failing, and then pick up a hobby that's so vision oriented.
Yes. Yeah.
because, you know, I'm a very sensible person.
That's how you do it. It's how you roll right there.
Mm-hmm. I know. Yep. I know.
Yep. Have to get in a plug for the Checker Spot Stitchers. Now, I have to find out why they're called the Checker Spot Stitchers. But they're in Silver Spring, Maryland. And somebody, every time we put up a podcast, somebody from Checker Spot, or not every time, but 98% of the time, somebody from Checker Spot shares the link, I assume, to the members of the Checker Spot Stitchers for our podcast. And I've always appreciated that. And they just posted something here today, I think it was. We're recording on Monday. Posted, and what really caught my eye is they're having Tony Gerdes. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Yes, Tony Gerdes, so. Her Fire and Ice that we talked about when she was a guest with us.
Yes, I love that piece.
She is teaching that piece, and that piece, I've seen that live a couple times. Holy smokes, is that nice. But on February 24 to 25, Clubhouse One, Leisure World, Silver Spring, Maryland, which might mean something to people in the East because they can drive there, but they're also allowing ghost stitching. So you can get in on Fire and Ice with Tony Gerdes at, it's $180 for the workshop. It's workshop only, and I think that means hotels, meals, and other things are on you. But there's a form, and you have to have the form filled out, and the money, form and money, have to be received by noon Eastern on December 1. So a little bit of time, but if you're interested in ghost stitching, Fire and Ice, yeah, this is an opportunity, because $180 to help support the cause and own the piece, not too bad. So we'll put a link for people on the website, but the link to get the form to fill out is CSSANG. So Checker Spot Stitchers, CSSANG. shutterfly.com/news, and there's a PDF form you can fill out and send in with your check. But yeah, they allow ghost stitching, so if you're interested in doing Fire and Ice, and that is one stunning piece, this is an opportunity to go stitch it with the Checker Spot Stitchers. And of course, thanks to Checker Spot Stitchers for always supporting us. Really appreciate that. So yep, yay. So just wanted to get that in there. And if I say so one more time, I'm going to scream. Now, this was interesting. I just found this today. Diane McDermott posted this in Needlepoint Nation. She's doing it was a simple pair, a striped pair, painted canvas. And this one spoke to me. She's trying to do her own stitches. She has this, it's a small piece, and she's trying to do her own stitches, rather than have a stitch guide, and she asked if there was a stitch guide. Mm-hmm. But the statement that caught me was, I'm paralyzed in progress by trying to get this perfect. So you can see how it caught my eye. my first attempt at my own stitches, love the canvas, but not enjoying deciding on stitches. Would love any comments. And she got plenty of help. I mean, she wasn't getting cheated on help. But it struck me because I related to that, in that you see so many examples of really stunning stuff. You know, people who can take a pair like that, that's striped, and put just the right stitch and just the right thread with it, and it just comes to life. And so you want to replicate that. But in this case, her first time, you don't have the experience, and I wouldn't have the experience either. And so you're trying so hard to make a standout piece of this simple little pair that pretty soon you just paralyze yourself. You just don't, you just can't, mm-hmm. You can't function, because just nothing feels right. And she had a couple stitches in there. I thought, well, I'd take that. But what got me thinking was, is that the kind of a situation where you take a step back and say, wait a minute, I need to simplify life here. I need to quit trying to be, create the Mona Lisa of needlepoint pairs.
Yeah.
And I need to back off and just get some simple stitches down. And for each stripe, because they were repetitive stripes, I'm just going to do the same stitch for each one. You know, like there's a wider pink thing. All right. All those, and people had suggested this, all those wide pink ones, just do them all the same. and just back off. Cause I really felt for her, because I know that position where I'm going to do this. And my first one out of the gate, I'm going to create the masterpiece. I'm going to create the one that everyone's jaws drop, and you're not. But you paralyze yourself by trying to do that, and then ultimately get frustrated, take the fun out of it, and that thing goes on a shelf somewhere, and you move on to something where somebody else tells you what to stitch and how to stitch it. And so I just felt for her. I could see that, but I thought, all right, well, how do you prevent that? And the only thing I could think of was simplify things. Just back off. Don't try to create the masterpiece. Try to create something that's really pleasing to you and that works and that you enjoy stitching. It's a small pair. Stitch it, finish it, and enjoy it for what it is, but then learn from it and say, all right, next time I think I'll do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Yeah, if you're chasing perfect, you'll never – well, A, you'll probably never achieve it.
Yes, right? You will. Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
But the thing is, though, if you don't allow yourself your first piece to be imperfect, then you have no room for growth, and you have you don't have a path through your needlework learning, right? I have this conversation with my son all the time, because he's 14 and he thinks, well, I'm not going to take that class or do that thing because I don't know how to do it. And I said, well, that's exactly the point. You're supposed to not know how to do it because you haven't taken the class yet. So, but that's kind of, I enjoy that part of it. Like I do the very best work that I can at each stage. And then I resist the urge. Like I'm looking at, these little daisies that I stitched, and I'm looking at them saying, you know what, now that I'm looking at them and sort of taking a second look, I probably could have stitched them differently and it would have come out better. And there's part of me that wants to rip it out, but then the other part of me says, you know what, though? If I spend my whole life ripping it out, then I'm never going to move on to the next piece that's going to be better. So let's let this piece be the beginning piece. Let it be imperfect. And then, you have to learn. You have to allow yourself. You know, we just talked about samplers that were purely for the purpose of learning. Sometimes pieces are purely for the purpose of practice, and they're not going to be perfect.
Yep. And exactly. I agree. Even though I'm always chasing perfect, I have to back myself off and say, nope, not going to happen this time, but let's do it and let's learn from it. And, make a note or two mental or on paper. And then the next time this situation crops up, then you learn from it. I should have done this rather than tearing it out four times. And because there does reach a point where you've worked so hard on a piece and you don't see any progress that just frustration sets in and you grow to hate the piece.
Right.
Whether you bought it for a reason and you shouldn't grow to hate it just because you made yourself frustrated. You got to find a way to get to the end, because ultimately you do need to finish it and hold it up and say, yep, pretty good there. This little old bit over here, I might have done something different, but by golly, pretty good given the circumstances. And in this case, the first time I've tried to pick my own stitches. So, yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Well, that was interesting. I felt for Diane. So go get them, Diane. Just do it. Mm-hmm. Just do it. All right. That's going to be enough, I think. I think it is.
All right. We have a good one on Sunday coming up.
Oh, boy. Yep. Yep, don't miss that. Mary Corbett with one T. With one T.
With one T, of course. Yes.
Right. Sunday. That's it.
All right. Take care, everyone.